I'm Jim Harrington, and this guy here,
I'm Bill Knight.
That's right, and he's wearing a Santa's cap.
Yeah, it's got a nice little white ball on it.
Did my Boston accent just sneak through there?
Yeah,
like
sure
Santa.
Did
I say Santa?
Yeah, I got Santa hat on.
You know, I've only been in broadcasting for like half a century. I'm still working on this accent thing, this regionalism. And I've done a pretty good job. I don't usually say things like idea.
Well, you know what happens is when you're in radio, you're surrounded by people that are trying to be articulate all the time, and you stay that way.
That's right.
But now that radio has changed and everybody works at home in their pajamas or whatever,
it's true.
We're surrounded by everyday language of the region of the country you're in, and you slip into that dialect. So, and I think that's kind of cool because that is real. That's what, you know,
but you would think after like 45 years, I would know that when I'm in front of a microphone, I don't say Santa.
Yeah, but you know what?
Santa Claus.
I mean, who taught us to be that way? We thought we had to be so proper and
did you do the broadcasting school thing?
Midwestern.
Did you do the broadcasting school thing?
No.
Neither did I. A lot of people have, but I was an apprentice. I learned by doing. First, I would introduce records in my car.
Oh, yeah.
Drove the passengers nuts.
Hey, I did it in front of we had the big, you know, the console stereo with the turntable, the radio. And I would sit there with a stack of 45s when I'd get home from junior high school or whatever. And I pretended I was on the top 40 station. I mean, if somebody ever came over, they would sit there and go,
"What's wrong
with
this boy?
Sorry for your son. He really needs to get some help."
I know.
They have medicine for that.
I drove, if I was in my dad's car and a good song came on, I would introduce
it. Up.
Yeah. And I
always hit
the post.
Or if the guy on the radio sat there and did a bit and you thought it was good, you either tried to mimic it or you did it. You said you did it better in your mind.
Yes.
I'm going to show him how to do it.
And he's on the radio. I could do that better. Watch.
But, you know, people do learn from imitation. And, you know, that was the old fashioned way of learning. And like you said, you got a job at a radio station. You might have swept the floors and done this. And one day you get the chance to crack the mic. You do. And there you are. I started
out. What was your first radio station?
Actually, it was KOAD.
Not your first job.
California.
Your first.
And you didn't get a salary. It was in a trailer owned by an attorney out of LA. And it was a write off for him. It was a joke. It really was a joke. But actually, I didn't cut my teeth there. I did that when I was young. I was teething. But
Six months old, folks.
I went to work for a veterans hospital, they had I forget what they called it, but basically we would do all the stuff to entertain the patients there, but they had an intercom radio station set up. It was a communication thing, but then they made it a radio station because one of the guys was an ex-radio guy that did all this stuff, and he found the volunteers and would train them to be radio hosts. So I would go in there and, you know, play the top 40 hits and the Vietnam era songs for these guys that were there. When you got a call from the seventh floor for a song, that was the crazy unit. So you never knew what that call was going to be. But that was how I learned. I learned by, and I was kind of ashamed of it because I thought, oh, I'm doing this volunteer.
Well, and we all did.
But looking back,
like
it was a proud thing to do.
My first time, on a radio show was on Saturday mornings on WALE in Fall River, Massachusetts. They had a program called Youth Keeps in Touch. I was 14 years old.
Right.
And I was a guest representing my high school, you know, and I was enamored with the fact that I was actually on the radio. And you know, when you're a young kid, you think the entire world, you think everybody, not a few people, everybody's listening to you.
Yeah.
So, you know, and first I was horrendous, But after a while, I got a little better, and the actual host gave up the position, and I hosted it for a while, the program. I was a guest first, then I became the host, and that was, I was.
And that was it. You were hooked.
Oh. And then.
You know, I got a funny story, not one that I tell a lot, but one of the things is, you know, we talked about colloquialism. I grew up in Fresno, California.
Yeah.
And if anybody knows their history of the Dust Bowl from Oklahoma, and when that happened, all these farmers, they migrated to the San Joaquin Valley. So there were a lot of Okies there that infiltrated my little hometown of Fresno. Mm-hmm. And they'd talk, they'd talk about tars, not tires, but they were tars. And I grew up around that. So I kind of had that colloquialism, you know, and, but I fought hard to get rid of it. Now, my first radio job, like I said, was KOAD. It was a write-off. It was kind of a joke. It was in a little trailer. And as a matter of fact, they had taken the hall bathroom, converted it to a little like closet studio. And the door was taken out to it because it was that small. Mm-hmm. And there's the hallway, and the wall behind you is the wall to the outside. A guy by the name of Troyce Key may not mean anything to you, but he had, you know, roots going back to Dick Clark in the old days. And he was the program director for a while. He kind of lived on the road, a vagabond of sorts, had a beautiful wife or girlfriend, whatever. And he lived in a Winnebago motorhome. He was a musician, and he was kind of a blues musician. Long story short, he decided to give up the reins and hit the road again. That's how his life was. And this guy that owned the local head shop, Brother Al, so he took over. And he said, well, we're going to change the makeup of the radio station, and we're going to be a lot more rhythmic. All right. So I was playing, you know, the Staple Singers and all these Stacks of Wax artists, Booker T and the MGs. I loved the music, and I was doing my little top 40, you know, sound, everything. And I was, you know, pretending I was on the big station in town, but I was on the little 250 watt station, but with this big voice and a little bit of that Okieism in me, people thought that I was a person of color, black.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, there on the air. I was in my, borrowed my brother's car to get to work. And somebody came by and painted a swastika on it, you know, and
really
the next day. Yeah, they did, you know, and I had to clean the car.
Wait, and then what the year next was this? Day,
I, because I worked weekends. The next
what
day
was this, Bill? What year?
About 73, 74. 74 is when it was. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the next day I'm there. And then they painted K-Nig on the station. That was, you know, a trailer, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. And I didn't like that. But I'm sitting there, you know, halfway through my show on this Sunday afternoon. And, you know, my dream was being a big radio star. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, I feel this trailer shake and hear this ba-boom, ba-boom. And I see little rays of light, you know, shining through the backside, shining into the studio. And there were two big shotgun holes, you know, where they drove by and they wanted to kill the bro that was on the air, me. So, and it was pathetic. They had a payphone in the studio. You had to click two wires. This is the real true what radio really was. And I said, that's it. I'm done in radio, but I got to finish out this show. And I sat there and I clicked two wires together. And a guy is a good friend of mine today by the name of Ken Hopper. His dad was a judge. But I called another station that was a big regional station that paid real money and had nice studios. And I clicked the wires, got the number, and called. And the guy was there on a Sunday and answered the phone. And I told him who I was and where I was. And he goes, well, do you have an air check for your show? What's an air check? You know, a tape of your show? No, I don't have that. We don't have anything to record here. Right. So you don't have anything scoped down? No. He goes, well, we require 3 years experience minimum. I've got a month experience. And he goes, well, I don't know. And I said, look, I'm on the radio right now. Listen to me and call me back. And then he goes, yeah, right. Okay. Hung up the phone and I said, man, I blew that one. That's it. I'm done.
He's never going to call you back. Yeah.
Never going to call me back. And I finished out that show. And a guy by the name of Bill Sweat came in to do the show. And I shook his hand and said, hey, it's been nice working with you. I'm done. I'm out of here. And he asked about the holes. And I said, you don't even want to know. And I walked down the hall. I, you know, went out the door, stepped down the steps, getting in the car. And he comes running back, goes, hey, you got a call. I'm sitting there going, who in the hell's calling me? So I go back. It was that guy. Had an interview the next day. So that experience, as scary as it was.
Was that the last time they shot at you on the air? Was that it?
Well, yeah, it's the only time I ever got shot at on the air. I mean, there's another story about being shot at, but we're not going to tell that one now.
That was a whole different. That was a whole different it really reason was. For that. Yeah,
oh, I'm sure it really was a whole different thing, and that's a funny story.
My stories about the beginning of my radio career pale in comparison to your story. I mean, no one shot at me. I did have my first full time radio job was in the summer of 67 on Cape Cod at WCODFM. The first summer they were on the air. As a matter of fact, I was hired just before they went on the air. The guy who owned the station was a guy named Ed Sullivan, but not the Ed Sullivan. He was a nice guy, and his audition was, I walked in, he handed me a piece of paper, he said, read this. And I read it, because he wasn't a radio guy. He wanted the station, he bought the station, he built the station, rather, but he wasn't really a radio guy. His background was something else, so the audition was, here, read this. I was horrendous, but he liked my voice and my attitude. So he hired me and he said, okay, can you be here tomorrow morning at 6 a.m.?
Yeah, really?
I thought, tomorrow? Yeah, he said, we're going on the air tomorrow at 6 a.m. And we're going to have a guy, if you can stick around, a guy will show you what buttons to press. This is the truth.
Yeah.
The next day, I had to turn the station on. I had written everything down, so And I was scared. You would, like, again, it goes back to, I was thinking everybody in the world was listening to me, the entire world was listening to this brand new radio station on Cape Cod.
Well, in reality, they probably were back in that time, because radio was everything.
Well, I got to tell you, I turned everything on. I did not know it was automated. Mm-hmm. And for those who are unfamiliar with automation back in the 60s and 70s, they were 12 inch reels. They were maybe 20 inch reels of tape that had all the music on it. And between each song was a tone that you couldn't hear on the radio that would trip something. Yeah. Maybe it would trip a jingle, it would trip a commercial or something like that. But what I didn't know, being the rookie, was when they put the tapes back in the box, they put them in what they call tails out. Meaning, in order to play that tape properly, you had to put it on the tape recorder, the tape machine. You had to snake it through the heads. And then you had to wind all the tape from the full reel to the empty reel on the bottom. And then when you play it, it would play the bottom reel. Yeah, back onto the original reel, right? So I didn't know that. I wound the tape down and I went through by the heads and did all the things you had to do. And got to the sound where it goes, I'm right there, I'm ready to go. And then when 6 o'clock hit, and I, hit the national anthem, dan, 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 we're on the air. My goodness, I hit all the buttons that we were on the air. And then I hit the automation and it goes, dun. The tape literally ended and it ran out. Yep. And it was flapping in the breeze and I was stuck on the radio. Now what do I do?
Because that's the nightmare.
Well, that's what happened. My first time on doing my own gig, as they would say loosely, was this embarrassment. I did have a disc or an album. I put it on and literally it could have been anything on the album. I didn't care. It just had to have sound. I put the album on, turned up the volume, let the album play, and I connected it properly. I wound the tape down and played it back. But I had to do a newscast in that hour, too, and I had never done a newscast in my life. Never. And I didn't realize that the AP machine didn't give you like organized
newscast.
It was like bits and pieces. They did have headlines that would come across and things. And then every hour they would have a newscast that you could read, but I didn't know what it came across. So I just thought that when you went to the machine, it would be there for you. So I ripped the page and went back into the newsroom and hit the sounder. And I didn't know what I was reading. And there was one thing that happened. When I went to the sports, there was a race in New York at, I think it was, I forgot which, Belmont or something, which was called the Futura Trot or something like that. I renamed it to the Fertility Trot. Literally renamed it to the Fertility Trot. And I had a person from Chatham, which was 30 or 40 miles, call the station to say, what was that race again? I said, the Fertility Trot. They said, well, that must be a very interesting race, because there's never been anything in history of horse racing that has been called a Fertility Trot that he could recollect. I had a lady call me at the end of the show, and she said she hated my show. And I said, Mom.
Mom,
will you stop calling me?
But yeah, you know, the good news is that that very humble and sad beginning, you ended up at CBS in New York. So you never know. We all start somewhere. We have the jitters the first time out, and even just a simple little index card that might have one or two sentences on it, all of a sudden, you know, you're staring at reading a book there because you're nervous. Something, a simple word or an abbreviation really becomes, you know, a brick wall for you.
You know, Bill, people look at you and they think, oh, what a great job. It's so easy. And they don't know about your beginnings, getting shot at, being targeted as, you know, the target of a racial attack, you know.
That's what it was.
Your first career, you know, your first job, rather. They don't know about the first day I walk into a studio and I have absolutely no real experience, and the guy entrusts his brand new $500,000 station. Here, go ahead, talk to the world. But, you know, by the end of the summer on that radio station, I had figured it out. So when I first started that, I was a quick study. I figured if I don't get it right soon, this is going to be a very short job. And so I didn't know, folks, if you're not familiar with radio, you sit at a console, at least you did in the old days, and there were these knobs, and they were called potentiometers. The short version of that word is POTS. So when a guy who was training me said, don't forget to adjust your POTS, make sure your levels are okay, I thought he was talking about cooking in the kitchen. I had no idea what a pot was. I didn't know what a pot was, but I didn't want to sound or look dumb, so I didn't ask questions then. I just sort of shook my head and thought, "What? I don't see any pots."
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is, you mentioned pots. I don't see any pans. You mentioned pots, and I'll tell you a story from another radio station. But most of us were naive kids, really naive kids. We weren't so naive after we got into the business. Trust me, I wasn't. But I remember, I think it was my third job, and I moved across the country, and I get this job, and, you know, I'm walking down the hall, and, you know, the guy that was the program director, he was kind of a, you know, he's a cool looking dude. And he goes, hey, Knight, get over here. And I go in. He goes, yeah, shut the door behind you. And I thought, damn, first day and I'm getting fired, you know. He goes, hey, have a seat.
And talk about cutting to the chase.
He kicks back in his chair, crosses his arms, and he's kind of rocking. And he goes, so I got to ask you a question. All right. Are you cool? I didn't know what he was talking about. I'm sitting there going, yeah, I'm a cool guy. Everyone knows that I'm a cool guy. I'm cooler than probably anybody here.
Ask my parents. All right,
That's good. Hey, we got a jock meeting at my place this Friday night. You don't have to bring anything. You'll be happy when you get there. I'm like, I had no idea. you know, and I walk in, I knock at the door and I walk in and I get hit with a wall. I'm sitting there going, hey, come on over, man. You know, hey, this is Bill and he's cooler, you know, and he's from California.
One toke over the line.
Oh, man. And I'm like going, oh, man, welcome to rock and roll.
The experiences we have in broadcasting and the people that we have met. And I have to tell you, I was probably the straightest, you know, toe the line disc jockey in the business.
I gotta commend you though. You know what? You did a life in your you've lived the radio life, but you've towed the line all the way through. Most of us that I could point out, go on Facebook and I could point them all out. I could tell you their stories, and you know, they didn't toe the straight and narrow, and I definitely didn't.
Most of my friends, all of my friends didn't toe the line. But see, when I was younger, you have the opportunity, but yeah, my dad was a lawyer. You know, I was brought up in a kind of a straight, narrow household, and
I didn't have a choice.
You know, a Catholic kid, right? You know, Catholic guilt.
Yeah.
You've heard about Catholic guilt, right? I mean,
I know it is.
Oh, yes. Everything's a sin, man. You know, if you look the wrong way, oh, that's a sin. And if you do it really bad, it's a mortal sin. Oh, boy. So I had that whole guilt trip thing, and something happened to, are we still on the air? Because the program just.
You have to be, because it says recording. I see your face and I see mine.
Oh, good. Because I don't see me, which is okay on my screen.
I know.
I know what it is. Do you know what? Seriously. They had a software update, and now they give you headlines on your computer, Microsoft Windows.
I don't get that. No.
Well, it just overrode the program that we're using to record this show with a pop-up with the headlines. And I didn't do that. So if it caught me by surprise, it's because it caught me by surprise. But anyway, I was brought up in a very, you know, strict, toe the line family. And I had the guilt trip thing. So most of my friends didn't have that. They were party animals, you know? Hey man, I used to be on the air with a guy, and I can say this now, the guy was a great guy and he's deceased now, so I can't get him in trouble, but I would be in one studio on the FM doing an oldie show. This was back in 1972. He'd be across the hall, and I could see him in the AM studio. And back in those days, AM was the heavyweight, and FM was the also-ran. And he would be smoking Mary J. Owana, you know?
He'd be smoking, I've heard of that stuff.
Yeah. He'd be smoking, that silly, the wacko weed. And the thing I learned about that, and I didn't do it because I didn't have an interest in it. I really didn't. I mean,
you didn't miss anything.
Well, I just had no interest. I smoked cigarettes, which was bad enough back then, you know, and I thank God every time I think back at how I smoked cigarettes and I got through without getting sick, I think, boy, it's like getting an A on a final you didn't study for, you know, it's like, whoa, was that lucky. But, he would sit in the room across from me doing his show, and he'd be smoking on the air. Because it was at nighttime. The program manager was gone for the day. No one was in the office, and it was just him and me, and I think there was a master control engineer. And as he smoked, everything he said got funnier and funnier to him. It didn't get funnier and funnier to the audience. It got funnier and funnier to him.
Oh, yeah. So
he'd do a time check and think it was hysterical, you know. 9:25.
Well, you know, this is on the air. Old disc jockeys and young ones too, listening to this right now and hearing that, are laughing, and stoners. Yeah, man.
Hey, it's true, man. 9:25.
Somebody that's the youth pastor probably listening from my church is going, I better give Bill a call. we got some work to do with him.
It's catch-up time.
And what was that other story, you know, about somebody chasing you with a gun? I want to hear that one. Not the one you told.
See, the thing about being Catholic, and you know, I feel sorry that other religions don't have this. You know, is we had something called confession, which is much cheaper than going to a psychiatrist. A psychiatrist can cost you know, $150 an hour, right? You go to a confession and you just dump all the things you've done wrong. You dump it in the confessional. You say, "Oh, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Boy, have I sinned this week. Holy smokes, I swore. I thought about this. I went to this website." Yeah. And then you just dump it, right? And then he absolves you. "Well, bless you, my son. God forgives you. Have a wonderful day and get out of my confessional," right? And you leave. And you feel like a new person. You've dumped all of your problems on this guy's lap, right? Now, right. As a Baptist, could you do that? Was there a way of unloading like we were able? I would suggest
you go meet with go privately
your pastor.
Meet with the preacher, yeah, and that would be about it.
He could see your face, right? He could see your face. See,
well,
when
I never had one get in my face. I think the funniest thing,
he could see you. He could see you, Bill.
Oh yeah,
in the confessional, right? When you go into the confessional, you close the curtain behind you. It is like a one way screen. He can't see you. You can see him sometimes, but he can't see you. So if you change your voice.
How many times did you change your voice?
Oh, God. Every week. He'd say things like, "Oh, you did that again, huh? I thought you straightened that out last week." But anyway, and then they changed it, Bill. Well, as I got into my adult life, they started having confession in you could sit with the priest and look at him in the same room. No more confessional type thing. It was like a right. chair next to a chair. And I hated that because the anonymity was gone. I thought, wait a second. I could hide before. I can't hide anymore. Now, nope. If I go in and tell him, you know, and then one more thing before, and I apologize for going on. My wife and I went over to France about 10 years ago. And we went to confession. And the priests over in France are totally different than the priests over in the U.S. In France, they want to know details of your sin. I'm serious.
Now, I'd be sitting there, you're writing a book? What are you doing over there?
This is the truth, though. They wanted to know, like, if you said, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned, well, I swore three times."
He said, "What'd you say?
Well, and what words do you, what did you use? What did you say?" You know, and if you got into real like kinky stuff, they wanted to know the details. And so I got back to the U.S. and I told a priest friend of mine. He said, "Yeah, you know, they have a reputation for that over there. They want to know the specifics. We're more generalists here. You know, we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Whereas over there, they want to know what you did wrong." You know,
so in other words, if I became a Catholic here in the United States,
yes,
you know, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned." Yes. Generally speaking, I'm sinned. Generally speaking, you know, if I were going to say that I sinned, I sinned.
Yes.
I could.
Well, you know what the thing is? When you say the "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned," you always say how long it's been since your last confession. "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 4 weeks since my last confession." Well, if you don't go for quite some time, you're embarrassed. You are embarrassed. Let's say it's been 2 years, right? You're embarrassed. So what's the first thing you do in the confessional? You lie. "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 3 weeks since my last confession." And then the first thing you say is, "Well, Father, I lied." you gotta cover that first, that the first
gotta cover your bases.
That's exactly right. Oh man. But
well, you know what, we've taken up a podcast with this, so we didn't talk about anything else, but I think it was fun for people to get a peek behind the curtain, but they don't even know what else is lurking behind the curtain of radio.
it's called Another Day. We have anotherday.com, which is a website which is going to have a lot of neat stuff on it when it's all put together, and we're working on it. It's
going to be after the holiday in the first quarter of the year, because besides doing this, we got families to tend to, and that's family true. Is always number one.
That's true. They are number one. I have to go to confession now. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes, hey. You do.
Hey, it has been fun, and
There's a lot of better things that you could do or be doing, but you know what? We really want you to spend the time with us.
Really? Otherwise, we're talking to ourselves, and I do that most of the time at home.
Yeah, I was going to say, it wouldn't be the first time nor the last.
Bye, Bill.
See ya.